Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Horror Weekly, the best foreign horror movie of all time. We asked more than 500,000 horror fans online, what was the best or favorite horror movie of theirs that's not in English, and we're here with their answers and ours. I did title this just the best foreign horror movie as an episode because what's the best horror movie not in English is just a terribly long title, but it's what I meant. I mean, who's to say what's foreign to what? Unfortunately, this episode is a day late because I'm in some Dante's Ninth Circle of Hell tech version where everything tech I touch turns to shit. I recorded the entire episode yesterday and the audio file didn't save or was corrupted or couldn't be played somehow. There wasn't enough time in the day to re-record the entire episode, so I'm doing it now. Apologies for the delay. I also went into the Friends of Horror Weekly supporter group to let everybody know the episode was going to be late and discovered that I can't post or comment in my own group suddenly, which is something I'll have to work out with Meta. So fingers crossed that this episode is one you'll ever even hear and that I don't get electrocuted by my microphone or my laptop doesn't turn into the metalhead Black Mirror device and come across the room and just kill me. But let's be optimistic and assume I make it through. So the voting here was really interesting. There were two non-English horror movies that absolutely dominated the voting. One was a clear winner, but not by a ton of votes, but enough to be convincing. The second place got just an enormous number of votes compared to everything else behind it. And then there was just basically all the rest of the second tier and then the stragglers. I'm going to go through the voting first from the bottom to the top. I'm curious before I say them, if you can guess what the two dominant best foreign horror movie choices were. And then after we go through the voting, I'm going to give my two choices because I have sort of a tie. In the interesting stragglers category, we have Martyrs, which got, you know, some votes, but not nearly as much as I expected. It was almost outvoted by Dead Snow, which is a movie I did not expect to see on the list at all. Although I'm not mad at it, that movie is fun as hell. There were a decent amount of votes for Wreck, The Wailing, which I was really glad to see because we did a previous episode of the best horror movies of whatever year The Wailing was, and that was our choice for the best horror movie of that year. There were some votes for the original The Vanishing, which gave me absolutely shudders because that is the one movie I think I've ever seen that I don't rewatch. No, it's not Sallow or Cannibal Holocaust or any of the other ones. It's for some reason The Vanishing just is incredibly unnerving to me. I've seen it twice, and I consider that enough. I want to give a shout out to Alexandra Bernau, who voted for the Polish movie Hellhole. Now, this movie doesn't belong in a best list in the company of the movies we're going to be talking about, but I could definitely see favorite or recent favorite. And that's one of the things I love best about when we do these community polls and movies pop up that I hadn't seen. I did know this movie existed and then somehow forgot. I was intrigued by the trailer. Since it's currently on Netflix, it was easy to find, so I went ahead and watched it. And it's better than I would have expected overall. It's not by any means a perfect movie, but it kind of does the opposite of what a lot of horror movies do. So it gets better as it goes, whereas a lot of movies that are average or slightly above average in the horror genre tend to start strong and then lose their way during the third act. This one is a pretty standard kind of Last Exorcism crossed with any number of creepy castle/monastery horror films you could think of. Again, pretty good atmosphere, pretty good visuals, but then it's not that the plot twist is so mind-blowing. It's not. It's just the execution seems to get better as the movie goes on. Like, the filmmakers or creators of this felt that the whole point of what they were trying to do is what's happening in the back half of the movie. So you can almost feel their energy build. You can feel their excitement grow. The performances get more lively. The effects get stronger. And then the ending, which I won't spoil, is pretty crazy and definitely kind of haunting. I mean, it's an Exorcism movie, and it's not a perfect movie, but it's five times better than Exorcist Believer and probably has like a tenth of the budget. So if you haven't seen Hellhole from 2020 and you like exorcism slash paranormal slash slight mystery movie vibes, check it out. I also want to tip my hat to a single vote, a one vote getter. This is the first time I think I've ever done this in a poll, because Paul's Toy Picture Page, of all entities, commented in the polling that their favorite horror movie not in English is the Spanish language version of Universal's Dracula. This is an epic choice. I know it's become de rigueur, or however you say that, over the years for the people who really fight for and defend this version, particularly comparing it against the Todd Browning, Bela Lugosi Dracula. I went into that really skeptical the first time I saw this movie, since I love the original Dracula. I don't like the Spanish language version better personally, but I can see the argument. The argument's not crazy. Cinematically, it might actually be better executed. But if you've listened to this podcast or followed the Horror Weekly page for any length of time, you'll know that I don't get stuck on comparing one thing to another, letting it ruin my enjoyment of what they are. And with the Spanish language Dracula, I let go the duel between the two movies and just tried to see how I actually felt about it. And what I discovered over time is that I find it incredibly rewatchable. And that's one of the best gifts a movie can give you. Now, keep in mind, there are literally tens of thousands of great horror movies not in English. There are definitely hundreds of full-on masterpieces over the span of time. So it's not like there was any kind of pretending here that we were going to come up with a comprehensive list. What I wanted to see was what kind of just floated to the top when you surprise people, when you sprung it into their timeline and just asked the question just to see what kind of clustered. And there are a lot of movies that are phenomenal, that are, I'm not going to be able to cover in a lot of detail just because there were so many and they just got a few votes, right? So like The Host or Tigers Are Not Afraid or I Saw the Devil, Goodnight Mommy, Diabolique, Eyes Without a Face. We could just go on and on and on. One movie came up a few times that actually might have been my vote for best overall, but I just don't consider it horror, which is Fritz Lang's M. I mean, I can see it. It's a serial killer. So, I mean, that's fine. For some reason, police procedurals, I don't know why, just a weird sticking point with me. I can't explain it. But movies like Zodiac and Seven, I'm absolutely comfortable saying that they're horror adjacent. I just wouldn't put them on the top of a horror list. I would just make a separate list. But M is just a treasure, and it's a trick that Fritz Lang had as a director that is really mind-blowing when you think about it, that he just had a knack for his movies not to age. I swear to God, if you can get past the black and white element, these movies feel like they're ahead of their time still. They feel like they could be made now, like Metropolis, like M, like Testament of Dr. Mabuse. I just recently saw his amazing movie called Ministry of Fear, which again is got just enough scary stuff in it to be sort of horror adjacent, but is an amazing movie and feels like David Fincher directing James Bond somehow. But M itself is an absolute treasure, and it's absolutely startling to consider that even among the best, even with Anthony Hopkins doing Hannibal Lecter, even with the phenomenal performance by Cameron Britton of Ed Kemper in Mindhunter, John Lithgow as the Trinity Killer, we could go on. But Peter Lorre as the serial killer in M might still be, after all of this time, after more than a century, might still be the best, most interesting, most layered, most nuanced performance of a serial killer in movie history. I remember M being one of the very first Blu-rays I ever bought, and when the menu loaded up on the screen and it showed that amazing image of Peter Lorre looking behind him with the chalked M on his back, realizing that he's been marked as the maniac that he is, I remember I hesitated to even play the movie because I knew I was going to be in for something special and I wanted to savor it. I didn't want it to end. Now, in basically the runner-up tier, movies that got hundreds of votes, we kick it off with the recent When Evil Lurks. Liam Bird commented in one of the votes saying, "More recently, I pick When Evil Lurks for its dark, engaging, and unflinching storytelling. I like that." And it was really interesting to me to see people in the thread of the voting for When Evil Lurks talking so much about the dog scene. It's cool when horror movies not only catch on, but catch on with something that's like sort of instant iconic. It happened with the bear in Annihilation, although I'm not sure Annihilation really caught on with anybody, but the bear scene is something that I see talked about online a lot. It obviously happened with the telephone pole scene in Hereditary. Actually, Hereditary might have had a few iconic scenes sprinkled about. And Damien Rugna, director of When Evil Lurks, deserved to have a couple iconic scenes from his previous movie, Terrified. But I don't really see the scenes from that movie discussed that much as so much as the overall tone and sense of dread. Subscriber to and supporter of this podcast, John Chadwick, drummed up a good number of votes for the Advent calendar, which he described as a great cursed object story that almost feels like an extended Twilight Zone episode. Then there were a lot of votes for Pan's Labyrinth and The Orphanage. But now let's do the top three. Solidly in third place was Audition. I guess I was a little surprised to see this so much higher than Ringu and the original The Grudge and etc. Audition just got a ton of votes and a ton of comments. I remember in Bravo's original 100 Scariest Movie Moments that Audition ranked, I think it was 11. It was definitely near the top 10. And it was one of the most entertaining segments of the whole countdown because you had these legendary horror directors like John Landis and Eli Roth and Rob Zombie who you could tell were just totally rattled by Audition. Rob Zombie actually said in the interview, and who knows what his opinion has become over time because this is fucking old now, but he was like, "I never get creeped out at horror movies, and it was like making me squirm in my seat." John Landis was like, "It's so unpleasant, the movie maybe shouldn't even exist," which is crazy thing to say as a horror director. Eli Roth was a little too into it, the way Eli Roth gets, but they just had the best, like, freshest commentary in the countdown, in that whole countdown, in that segment of people just blurting out like, this movie's out of control. What's going on? Just amazing reactions from people who make movies for a living. It's very hard for people who direct movies to suspend disbelief. They can see the cameras and the work. Like, it's hard to for them to see it in the way that regular viewers will see a movie, but Audition somehow waved its evil magic wand at them and made them feel like they lived that movie. And there was something, I think it was a writer for Fangoria, I forget her name, unfortunately, but it's in the Bravo segment, you can go look it up. She said something really, really smart about Audition, which is that the torture implements she's using at the end of that movie, and the movie is like basically a build up to those last, you know, 20 minutes or so. And a lot of movies just don't have the patience to do that anymore. But what she said was the torture, the thing she's using for torture, the needles and the wires, are all really delicate, really light, almost not their kind of objects. And in a genre where knives become bigger knives, then become machetes, then become chainsaws, then become logs flying off of trucks, to have some of like the worst horror imaginable coming down to some needles and some wire and a sack is just really brilliant and kind of unique. To this day, I think that one of the reasons Phantasm maintains its kind of like scary reputation and is an immortal kind of film is the Sentinel spheres are unexpectedly small for horror weapons, but incredibly deadly. There's something about the surgical side of weaponry that when the horror genre gets it right is unforgettable. Okay, now in second place with hundreds and hundreds of votes was Train to Busan. This is not surprising to me. Part of me thought it might actually win the voting. It's just a perfect blend of emotional horror movie without being corny or cliche or on the nose, and then truly terrifying sequences and really, really entertaining sequences. Characters that you absolutely, based on just very little information, because the movie moves pretty fast, that somehow you grow to care a great deal for. And they're also not simple characters. This is one of the problems that I have, don't get mad at me here, that I've always had with The Mist, which is obviously an excellent movie, but for some reason just never hits with me. And it's not the ending. I love the ending. I love the ending of the story and I love the ending of the movie. I like them both. It's this thing I'm talking about with Train to Busan's characters. The characters in The Mist, to me, are so telegraphed. It's so obvious who's good and who's bad. It's the people who are good. They're making, you know, relatively complicated moral decisions in the middle of a crisis, but they're not like in Train to Busan. The lead character is kind of like an awful person. His eventual friend and zombie killing partner, Sang-hwa, who kind of steals the movie in a sense, is pretty overbearing at times, like dismissive of other people's like opinions. They're flawed people who like step it up throughout the crisis, kind of dig deep and find the good stuff inside of them without like erasing that it was ever there. And The Mist, like Thomas Jane and Laurie Holden and Toby Jones, these characters are like pretty much perfect. If I was the castaway situation, like in the middle of the ocean and I was on a life raft and I had to make it like, you know, 50 days with limited water and food, I mean, I would pick these three people to be in the life raft with me with no hesitation. They're good people. right? Like, you know from the jump. You don't know from the jump in Train to Busan that these people are going to work out the way that they do. You can't really, like, bet money on it based on what you know about them at the beginning. But instantly, you've got these good characters in the mist. And then, you know, Andre Brauer's character sucks. Mrs. Carmody's one of the most loathsome villains in horror history. I don't know. You can message the Horror Weekly page and fight for this movie and let me know if I'm wrong. Like, it's been a while since I've seen it. I just find the characters kind of two-dimensional at best. Train to Busan manages to not give you just three-dimensional characters, but it wedges in a really interesting emotional charge in a movie that's got the simplest plot imaginable. I mean, this fucking movie is going from point A to point Z. We know it. It's in the title. Or I guess since it's Busan, it should be from point A to point B, whatever. Plus, it gets a really limited kind of closed location just perfectly right, which is not easy for a horror movie to do. And when a horror movie pulls that off, it's really exciting. I mean, Lifeboat by Alfred Hitchcock isn't a horror movie per se, but he took that movie on with the challenge. He wanted the challenge of, can I set a movie in a tiny boat and be nowhere else, like nowhere else for the entire movie, and still have it be riveting and hypnotic to watch and interesting? And goddammit, he pulls it off. This is part of the reason why Ryan Reynolds' Buried is so affecting to a lot of horror fans. So Train to Busan is pretty much excellence across the board. But it did not win. And the reason it didn't win is because of Let the Right One In. This movie just ran away with the voting. Now, I knew Let the Right One In was going to show up, and I thought it might even make a strong showing, but to have it just steamroll its competition on the way to the top as best foreign horror movie or best horror movie not in English of all time, according to the Horror Weekly community, was pretty gratifying. You can't count on these things working out. There are movies that I have a ton of affection for, like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, that barely got any votes at all. But not only did Let the Right One In get a ton of votes, it generated the most discussion of any of the movies in any of the threads. And it got the most follow-up comments of, oh man, now I gotta go rewatch this. I wanna see it again. And stuff like that is just the best. Now, I'm not gonna do any kind of dive into this because this movie is so great and classic. It would, if to even touch it, it would deserve its own full episode. Just suffice to say that in what might be horror's most crowded subgenre, the vampire subgenre, it might be the best movie on the topic ever made. And that is amazing when you consider the competition. And as with Dracula, it helps when it comes from a great novel from an incredibly talented author. All right, let me put in my two picks for contenders for the best horror movie not in English of all time. They're both Japanese. Now, I had an interesting experience recently. I went to see Dune Part 2, which I'm still kind of processing. It's definitely an amazing theatrical experience for sure. It's got tons of great stuff in it. I did not expect Austin Butler to steal the movie. But Denis, the director of Dune Part 2, ruffled some feathers online recently when he was quoted in an interview saying that he doesn't care about dialogue in movies, that he thinks of movies as visual experiences, and that he wishes he can make a movie with almost no dialogue in it at all. Go see No One Will Save You. Now, the backlash to this was predictably online. It was predictably over the top. The quote, obviously, is a little dumb, let's say. I mean, the idea of movies, the idea of dialogue being inessential to movies, like overall, if you applied it to like all movies, is absolutely absurd. I'm a pretty visual thinker. when I think of movies, like they when they pop into my head, I can kind of see the scenes of my favorite movies kind of playing out like I'm watching them. And I think to myself, I thought to myself after reading this quote, like when I started just randomly surprising myself with horror movies, right? Like I would Google, you know, best horror movies of a certain year and then just see the thumbnails pop up and think, okay, Exorcist 3, what's the first thing I think of when I see Exorcist 3? And it is a visual in that case. It is the Shears jump scare scene. But like Nightmare on Elm Street, Dream Warriors, the first thing that popped in my head wasn't a visual. It was the Welcome to Prime Time line. With John Carpenter movies, often the first thing that pops into my head is music, like with Halloween or with Christine with Rock and Roll is Here to Stay, or You Can Keep on Knocking, but You Can't Come In. The point is to give visuals the kind of primacy that Denis is giving it and hinting that it's excluding the other stuff is an obviously absurd argument. And I think that he means it in the context of, you know, other people do other things. This is the way I would do it, or I am doing it. I don't think, or I would hope not, that he doesn't mean it applies to everyone or all films, but I think that's how a lot of people on the internet took it. So it led to a lot of kind of over-the-top, overheated arguing. But why am I even talking about this in this context? Well, immediately after I saw Dune Part 2 the next day, I sat down and watched the first couple episodes of FX's new show, Shogun. And I was about midway through the second episode when this thought started sneaking up on me from the back of my head, just crawling over my gray matter. And it was bothering me while I was watching the show. And I was waiting for this thought to be born so I could figure out what the hell was distracting me. And then this sentence just popped into my head, which was, this is better than Dune Part 2. Now, I don't know that I mean that in the theater sense. I'm not sure sitting down and watching 2 hours of Shogun in the theater would be as fun for me as watching Dune Part 2 in the theater. But I think in pretty much every other way, I find it better made, more interesting, less flawed, more compelling. It's just one of my favorite TV experiences in recent memory, at least so far. I mean, there's a bunch of episodes. I think this thing is 10 episodes long instead of the usual 8. The episodes are chunky. They're meaty. They're not short, and they have a lot going on in them. And the only reason I was even thinking this is because I saw one immediately after the other, so I was just naturally kind of comparing it because it was my most recent viewing experiences. And it took me immensely by surprise because Dune 2 is being hailed as great as Star Wars and getting all kinds of acclaim, so I would have never expected to sit down and watch an FX show immediately afterwards and think that it was better. But here we are. And all this is to say, the only thing that kind of checks me on this or holds me back is I have a deep affinity for cultural Japanese things. One of my favorite authors of all time is an author named Mishima. There's a ton of others like Kawabata that are kind of like my desert island authors. So who knows? Maybe I overrate these things just out of personal preference a little bit, but what am I going to do? I have to say what I believe in and am passionate about. So let's start with the 1964 film Onibaba. Now, to be the best, I don't want to do what we hate as horror fans in reverse. That complaint, timely since the Academy Awards are coming up, that horror gets ignored. We were just talking about on the Horror Weekly page what a travesty it was that Lupita got ignored for her performance in Jordan Peele's Us. And there are countless other examples. So I don't want to pick something for best horror and just have it be only horror. I want it to be a contender for best movie, and Onibaba might be one of the best movies ever made in any genre. It's one of those rare movies that could even be potentially life-changing for some people. It was directed by Kenito Shindo, a gentleman who was really fiercely independent filmmaker through his whole life and worked almost to the age of 100. You want to talk about passion, but the kind of setup for this movie is that it's set during a civil war in medieval Japan. There are two women, a mother and a daughter-in-law, who kill fighting soldiers who are fighting each other and then end up straggling or getting lost and being wounded. They kill them while they're vulnerable to steal their armor and possessions so that they can sell them to get food. And then there's one man who's a deserter from the army who was a friend of the son of one of the women and husband of the other woman, the daughter-in-law, obviously. He's a friend of his. He comes back, tells them that him and the son slash husband deserted the army, and then he got killed, and he's the only one who got away. So it's a very, very small cast. And this new man is going to come between the mother and daughter-in-law, and that drives most of the drama of the movie. Now, if someone were to come to me and say that they had a conspiracy theory, and that their conspiracy theory is that there are a handful of movies, sort of under the Silver Lake style, that aren't actually movies, they're spells, they're magic spells. There's only a few of them. And they argued that Onibaba is one of them, that it's not even a movie, it's a spell. I would absolutely believe this conspiracy theory. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it. It's weird because it's got a lot of David Lynch in it. But before you snag on that, if you're a huge fan of David Lynch, fair enough. But if that makes you think, you know, weird and hard to understand and nonlinear plots or whatever, imagine David Lynch filming something with an absolutely straight ahead plot, with none of his, like, storytelling time jumps or disjointed logic. It's just they put a gun to David Lynch's head and they were like, you're filming a straight linear movie with an absolutely understandable story, go. You might get something like Onibaba because the story is very, very simple and very straight ahead. But the visuals of the movie just take these incredible timeouts or detours to just show grass, and I mean tall grass, like reeds, where the hole, the evil hole that leads to, you know, the deaths of countless soldiers, or at least where their bodies are being thrown, is surrounded by this absolutely oceanic-sized field of grass. And, you know, one of the things that is most magical about David Lynch in Twin Peaks is the way he would kind of slow film tree branches in the wind or, like, stoplights rocking back and forth at intersections. And that's why I say Onibaba is very Lynchian, because the filming of the grass has, it's beautiful, absolutely gorgeous, just absolutely devastatingly dark and interesting visuals, but there's also a meaning there, and you can tell there's a meaning there. And I have seen this movie countless times, and I always feel like it's on the tip of my tongue what these shots of this grass mean, and then I never quite get it. And it's the opposite of frustrating. It means that the movie is always absolutely new, absolutely fresh to me, even though I've seen it a ton of times, because there's something even greater than the great movie that's in front of me that's just hovering there, ready to grab, right around the borders of the frame. and you can't quite get there, but you never want to stop trying. Now, the view of humanity in this movie is as dark as I've ever seen in a movie. There's just, I can't even think of a way to portray something more fundamentally bleak than the hell these characters are living in and what's motivating them and what they're striving for. It's weird because it's like one step extra to zombie in here, because even though there may not be anything supernatural besides the mask in this movie, there may not be demons, although there may, but what these people are doing is they're basically finding wounded soldiers lost or injured in fields, killing them, selling their products, and turning that into food. They're turning living people into dead people into food. And you see the whole process in the film. You see them murdering people. You see them going, collecting the possessions, going to trade the possessions at what's essentially like a pawn shop. And then getting sacks of millet back so that they can eat. Or sometimes if they get lucky because they got like really good armor or really expensive swords off their victims, they get some meat or something fancier than just grain. There's a constant war raging in the background of Onibama. That's what's generating all of these wounded soldiers and deserters and victims. But it flips kind of like the war movie on its head. It's like the recent Zone of Interest, where the movie isn't showing you much of the concentration camp in the background of the movie. You're spending time with the banality of the family at the foreground of the movie. In this movie, you don't see much of the war. You just see small individual battles. But in war movies, when you're in a village, you're at a place, and all of a sudden a pillar of fire and smoke shows up on the horizon, you're terrified. That means the battle's swinging your way and might be heading to your village. And there's an absolutely bone-curdling scene in Onibaba where the mother and her daughter-in-law are just working, doing their chores, doing whatever to stay alive. And then you hear a sound and they look up and they see this column of smoke in the horizon. And the mother gets like an excited look on her face. And she goes, "Up, there's battling. There's prey heading our way. We have victims coming. We'll be able to eat some more." It's just a startling reaction to violence to be excited to be able to inflict your own violence. There is a tiny sliver of justification for all of this mayhem for the mother, because the war, after all, took her son, and her life is now completely changed. When her son was home before the war, they were farmers. They weren't roaming the fields massacring wounded people. They were just making a living, a hard scrabble living, but a living nonetheless. Their lives have changed because of the war and because of the loss of the son. So now they can't generate enough on the farm to make a living, so they've turned to this more evil route. But you get the feeling from the mother that a lot of times when she's killing the soldiers, she's thinking, "You're the people that took my son from me. You deserve what you get." Of course, that justification is completely flimsy and not morally worth it, but it helps give her a slightly sympathetic edge in a movie where it could have easily just been an over-the-top villain. There's something really cool that happens here that makes this, in my mind, one of the absolute shining jewels of the horror genre, where the man that shows up and is obviously interested in the daughter-in-law because she's young and attractive, he is clearly no good. I mean, he's a military deserter. He helps them kill a wounded samurai without them even asking him to. Like, it's something you can tell he was naturally going to do on his own if they weren't there. And he never really says anything in the film that gives you any kind of feeling that he has any kind of aspiration for anything that's not directly to his benefit. But him and the daughter-in-law fall in love, or at least in lust, or they get intrigued by each other. And it generates a lot of the film's energy as they're running back and forth covertly to sneak around and meet each other and have their affair bloom. And they're tearing through these tall grass with the wind blowing and the grass waving like it literally looks like water, except for on the ground, on the land. It's, if you haven't seen it, it's remarkable. But they're running back and forth, sneaking in the middle of the night to each other. And they're laughing, they're giggling, they're twirling. They're just so excited. I wouldn't have been surprised to see them do cartwheels. They're just so charged with, we were so bored and nothing's really going on. And all of a sudden there's this new interesting person for me to explore. And then what happens is by more murder, by tricking a samurai general to fall into this almost endless hole, the mother comes by a demon mask. And she starts sneaking out, putting it on, and confronting the daughter-in-law when she's trying to sneak. She puts herself in her path and scares her, thinking there's a demon that you're sleeping with a man, you're not married, and the demons don't like it, and they're out to get you, and you're going to go to hell. You're going to be damned for your immoral behavior. And the reason I said this is like a horror jewel is it takes those scenes of joyful running back and forth to see each other and turns them into sheer scenes of terror, fleeing the demon in the middle of the night. Same run, same motions, almost looking the same as the joyful running, except for now it's absolutely terrified. And this is the alchemy of the horror genre, to take a visual that looks really fun and exuberant and change it in a very subtle way, not even really changing the visual so much as the context of it, and make it blisteringly terrifying. When you see a regular person pick up a pen, it's the most boring visual you can imagine. When you see Hannibal Lecter pick up a pen, people are going to die. And this is what Onibaba does. Now, I don't want to spoil the ending or how the demon mask works or the confrontation between the mother and the samurai general, which is one of the most haunting trips and conversations I've ever seen in a movie. I'll just let you, if you haven't seen it, enjoy all that on your own. There is an amazing moment when the mother does confront the samurai general and asks him why he's wearing a mask. And he tells her, and this may or may not be true, that he wanted to protect his face in battle because he's the handsomest man in all of Kyoto, one of Japan's largest cities. And he wanted to shield his face so it wouldn't be marred or damaged in the battle. This is his story. And she stops and says to him, I'm helping you. The price I ask is that you take off your mask and show me the most handsome face. She goes, I've never seen anything beautiful in my entire life since I was born. And her line delivery here is devastating. You 1,000% believe that you're looking at a human being who feels like they've literally led a life of pure misery and they're just trying to get by, and nothing, she even says, nothing has ever taken my breath away. Nothing, I've never seen anything that's taken my breath away. And between the sheer, almost flipped photo negative magnificence of that, and what the charge that this movie is releasing on the viewer, if they're paying attention, matched with the incredible visuals, the one-of-a-kind mask that kind of got ripped off by the black phone mask and has been homaged in a bunch of other horror movies, but is just perfect and exquisite here. the casual amounts of evil this movie throws around in the ultimate fates of its characters. I mean, we were talking about The Mist earlier. There's nothing, even The Mist's ending has nothing on Onibaba for Bleak. But on top of all that, the most special thing about this is this movie has a magic to it and a meaning to it that shifts around like the grass in the wind, leaning one way one time you watch it, another way another time you watch it. It's never completely still. It's never something you can completely own or master as a viewer and be like, oh, I got it, now I understand it. But not in a frustrating way, in the best way imaginable. Now, the other movie I want to mention here is Harakiri, which I think a lot of people wouldn't consider a horror movie, but I definitely do, as a horror movie in the way that Eden Lake is a horror movie. I should also mention that it's my favorite movie of all time in any genre. If I had to take one movie to a desert island with me, Harakiri is it. Now, I will absolutely not spoil anything about Harakiri because my favorite movie watching experience of my entire life is this movie. And there is a twist, or I should say a couple, that I absolutely did not see coming that were phenomenal. And you know early on, this is one of the few things I'll say, you know early on when a character says something and then another character who is seemingly completely unrelated to the first character says the exact same thing in the exact same cadence with the exact same words in the exact same way, that you are in a weirder place than you imagined you were and something is going on here and you're struggling to figure it out. And I remember the first time I watched it, I was at a loss. I was trying to figure out why I was hearing an exact repetition of the same words from someone else's mouth. Was this supernatural? Is this coincidence? Is this just badly made? What's going on here? And as the movie slowly unrolls its perfect explanation for why this is happening, it was an endless, it was like fireworks. Like imagine a line of gunpowder on the ground with fireworks set in it every 10 feet. And it goes, you know, a mile as far as the eye can see. And you light the gunpowder and then it just, the fire travels along it and the fireworks keep going off one after another after another. That was my experience of watching this movie thinking, no, this movie can't be doing this. Wait, this can't be the explanation. Is this movie going there? Oh my God, it's going there. It was detonation after detonation after detonation, mentally and emotionally realizing what this movie was up to. It's the darkest movie I've ever seen. It makes The Mist look like Sound of Music. It's directed by an absolute master, a guy named Masaki Kobayashi, who also did the excellent Samurai Rebellion and Human Condition, among just tons of other amazing stuff, but truly one of the greatest directors to ever lived. It stars Tetsuya Nakadai, who it might be my pick for the most talented actor I've ever seen on screen. It's just an embarrassment of riches. And for the horror of it, midway through to this day, and I've seen a lot of extreme shit, the most unnerving thing, soul-crushing thing I've ever seen on screen happens midway through this movie. You'll know it. You'll know what I'm talking about when you see it. There's 0% chance that you don't know what I'm talking about if you've seen this movie, and 0% chance you won't know what I'm talking about if you go watch it after listening to this. It is the worst thing I can... I can't even imagine how you would top it as worst. And I know that sounds like a lot of buildup and like whatever. And is it like the goriest or the most extreme? Like, of course not. This is an older movie. You know, they had their own you know, restrictions or whatever, but just not only what they put on screen, but what it's implying and what the character is going through and why they're going through it and why they can't stop going through it is soul shattering. And like I said, I'm being very careful not to spoil a single thing about this movie, because you shouldn't have anything spoiled before you watch it. But I will tell you what I think the meaning of the end of this movie is, which might be the most profound meaning I've ever seen in a film. Because what the end of Harakiri does, what it's saying essentially, is that nothing matters except how it matters to you. Everything can be reset. Everything can be covered up. Everything will eventually go away. And the only thing that matters is how you feel about what your life is, what your actions represent. And then, is that enough for you? Right? It's the ending of Harakiri is the equivalent to, why is humanity bothering to do anything if the entire universe is going to collapse in on itself and die? If the earth is going to get burned to a cinder by the sun? Let's say all of that is certain. Then why bother with anything? Why bother with anything today or tomorrow or whenever? And Harakiri, more than any movie I've ever known, not just horror movie, any movie that I've ever known, has an answer to that question. And the answer is, I'm not going to look away. The movie says, I'm not looking away from this reality. As a matter of fact, I'm going to portray the reality that nothing matters. And then I'm going to show you how everything might actually matter. To me, it's just the single greatest movie of all time. So there you have it. The best foreign horror movie, or best horror movie not in English, of all time, as judged by the Horror Weekly community, which is you and me. I pick Onibaba as the best horror movie of all time, not in English. If you're taking something that would conventionally be labeled horror, I say it's Harakiri if you expand the horror horizon a little bit, but I can easily see Let the Right One In, or Audition, or Train to Busan, or a bunch of others that were in the voting as the winner or worthy contenders for sure. Thank you so much to everyone who voted and participated. The discussions were phenomenal. Thank you for your patience with the episode being late. Hopefully this is recording, because if you're not hearing this episode, then it's failed for a second time, and I've taken the Harakiri title more seriously than I wanted to. I'm off to go try to repair the Facebook supporter group. Hang in there, guys. I saw some new members showing up, which I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that, and how much the people in there appreciate that. They do such a great job of welcoming and noticing when new people arrive. This is the poet Blake said, the engine of creation. This is the group where I want to toss around ideas and really kind of build new ideas, new formats for the podcast, new ideas for episodes with a direct group of people. I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to join and check out. You don't have to stay. As soon as you leave, the obligation is gone like magic, so you can just pop in, check things out, stay if you'd like. We'd love to have you. That's all for now. Until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.